This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Consider for a moment the story of the Golden Lion Tamarin. These fair-haired, long-tailed monkeys once roamed the Atlantic coastal forests of Brazil in large numbers, but human population expansion and logging now threaten the existence of the primate. Today, less than 3% of the forest is suitable for them to live in. The Golden Lion Tamarin is only one of the more than 1,900 animals and plants on the endangered species list. And some scientists are worried that we face a mass extinction so rapid it could rival the asteroid impact that destroyed the dinosaurs. Stuart Pym is certainly concerned. He's a conservation biologist at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment. His work centers on curbing the accelerated rate of species extinction and restoring the world's biodiversity. Stuart regularly travels to the Amazon, Africa, and the Everglades to research the shifting balance of nature. We caught him just before he departs on another conservation journey. Stuart Pym, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
It's great to be back. Thank you so much.
You wrote in your book 11 years ago, The World According to Pym, A Scientist Audits the Earth, about extinction, species extinction was a concern then. It's been a concern for a while. But look, it's a part of nature. This has been going on for a long time. Why should we be worried?
Extinction is like death and taxes. Yes, it's inevitable, but you don't want too many people dying at once and you don't want to pay too much tax. It's a matter of rate. What's happening at the moment is that we are driving species to extinction 100, maybe 1,000 times faster than we should. And that is not natural. Events of that magnitude have only happened 5 times previously in Earth's history. The last one, the very bad last day of the Cretaceous, when an asteroid obliterated a lot of species, including the dinosaurs. We are facing that kind of threat to the variety of life on Earth now.
But look, you said it. It has happened 5 times before. The Earth goes on. Maybe this is number 6.
You know, if you talk to paleontologists, they are unreasonably cheerful people. They will say, look, Stuart, we recovered from the last one. And I will say, yes, but it took 10 million years to do so. This is not something that we're going to hold our breath and it's going to be over. If we lose biodiversity, we're going to lose biodiversity not just for the lives of our children and grandchildren, but countless generations of people to come who are going to live in an impoverished planet.
Well, I'm going to stick with this idea for just a little bit longer because you said, too, that it was unnatural. But look, we are a part of nature, human beings. Our ingenuity is a natural phenomenon. It is not supernatural, right? I mean, this is something that's ours. And this is what we do.
You know, my children, and I now have a grandson, if you watch your children breaking something out of spite, out of being bad-tempered, you don't say, oh, that's a natural thing. You say, stop it. And so much of what we're doing is careless. It's a folly. It's something we could be doing very differently. And if we did it differently, our lives would be better as a consequence.
Give us an example.
One of the major things that explain why biodiversity, one of the major reasons why biodiversity is important, is what we call ecosystem services or nature services for short. Because we're burning tropical forests, rainforests, if you like, at the rate that we are, we're putting 1.5 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere. I love sounding like Carl Sagan, billions and billions of tons. That constitutes about 15% of all the carbon emissions. Does that make a difference? Well, yes, if you live in the coasts of North Carolina, and we know that sea level rise is coming up, we know that the frequency of Category 3, 4, and 5 hurricanes is is increasing within the Atlantic. Those consequences, the extreme heat that we're seeing year after year after year, are in part a consequence of our burning tropical forests. They're also a consequence of our using a lot of energy and fossil fuels. But that's tropical forests that we're burning and putting out those billions and billions of tons is something that we could stop. It's something we could stop for peanuts, as it were, for very small amounts of money, and we would not have the climate catastrophes that we're having. That's what I mean by folly. We don't need to do that. There are alternative actions. Those actions are cheap, and they make a lot of difference to the climate, but also to the biodiversity. If you destroy a forest, you convert it into carbon in the atmosphere that we don't want, and you destroy species at the same time. We can correct that.
And that's the interesting thing about your work, is that for so long the environment has always been pitted against the economy, and that just doesn't need to be the case, because it is precisely our ingenuity and economic engines that can be fired up that can reverse some of this process.
I think it's very easy for people to take cheap shots at the environment and say it's environment versus jobs. You know, it rarely is. We depend on the environment in a variety of ways that make a huge amount of difference economically. It certainly is good to destroy the environment if you're going to make a fast buck from doing so. But for the people in the long term and over the large scale, looking after the environment makes very good economic sense.
We talked about the golden lion tamarin at the beginning of this program to illustrate the problem of endangered species. But actually, what has happened to them is a kind of a success story.
It's very much a success story, and it is a great example, one I'm very proud of, where we can make a difference. And the way that we made a difference there was working with my colleagues in the Nicholas School. We mapped out where we thought the greatest number of endangered species were in all of the Americas. Chose the Americas because we knew we could fly there. You know, I run a lot of my research program on Delta frequent flyer miles. And we knew that the state of Rio de Janeiro, just outside the city, was the place, the biggest concentration of threatened species. And when we got there, we realized that the reason that so many species were threatened is because the forest that remains is in tiny patches, an isolated fragment here, an isolated fragment there. And, you know, those populations of golden lion tamarins need to go forth and multiply. And if there's a barrier in terms of a cattle pasture, they can't cross it. We went down there, we looked at this and thought, well, how much would it cost to buy the cattle pasture? And the answer was not only not a lot, but it was amount of money about equivalent to $10 a ton for carbon. Now, that means that if you put a price on carbon, $10, that it was better to be growing carbon on that cattle pasture than growing cattle. Now, if any people out there are farmers, they must think that is really bad cattle pasture. And it is. It's wretched, and the cattle are starving, and the vultures are just standing there ready to eat them when they die. Nonetheless, it's bad land, and it's better growing forest than cows. And so we bought the cattle pasture. We are now growing trees back on that cattle pasture and connecting together these isolated fragments so our golden lion tamarins and thousands of other species can now begin to be connected. We did it on carbon offsets, as we call it, of getting people to agree to offset their carbon. I make no bones about it. I went around telling people that they were sinning. Sitting to the tune of 7 tons of carbon per year, you know, for $70 less than we probably spend on Starbucks, you can be free of carbon sin.
Mm-hmm.
And People gave us the money. We gave that money to a Brazilian organization. They bought the land. And now the Brazilian Park Service, the Instituto Chico Mendes, is going to create a very large protected area from the fragments that we help connect.
What happened to the herders?
Well, as I said, this is not particularly good grazing land. So they got a fair market price for their land. I suspect they got a little bit more. So they were happy, we were happy, and we're sucking up, you know, hundreds, thousands of tons of carbon out of the atmosphere where we don't want it to be, and saving species at the same time.
On the State of Things today, my guest, Stuart Pym. He is Doris Duke Professor of Conservation Ecology at Duke University. Just ahead, we'll talk with him about some of the species that we have already lost and how to slow things down, the accelerated rate of extinction. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest this hour is Stuart Pym. He is Doris Duke Professor of Ecology at Duke University's Nichols School of Environment. Also works to prevent the premature extinction of species and protect the Earth's biodiversity. And you began your work as a conservation biologist before that term even existed. Tell us about that bird-watching stint in Hawaii in the 1970s.
Well, I've always been a bird watcher since I was a teen. And, you know, when you go off bird watching, you take your field guide with you and there's a list of birds and you want to see them. I did that in Hawaii and realized that I wasn't going to see the species there. Some of them had gone extinct. Some of them were on the verge of going extinct. One I saw that's simply gone extinct since. And that did two things for me. The first was a sense of moral outrage, that we're doing so much to the planet that is bad and irreversible, that there's part of this culture of our planet that we've lost forever. We have destroyed it carelessly. So that was the ethical side of what motivates me. But the other side was, as a scientist, I realized that I had the tools, or could develop the tools, that would enable me to fix the problem. So, you know, I'm a scientist who believes I have a moral obligation to do something about the problems that I see. Hawaii was very important in my career development in bringing those two ideas together.
Where were you in your career at the time?
Just got my PhD. I was fortunate in that I was already publishing in the top scientific journals of the time, of Nature and Science. But, you know, I thought, what will people think about me, you know, 40 years from, 30 years from now, i.e. now? What will they think about me if I published all these scientific papers but not done any good? And that was the turning point in my career.
Where were you headed? What did you think you were doing with
your science? I was doing a lot of very clever, you know, academic ecology. But you know, it was unsatisfying because you can't look at what's going on in the world. Well, I mean, some people can, but I couldn't look at what's going on in the world and not do something about it.
Now, it's precisely that activism that some will say is part of our problem. We think we can solve a problem, but a lot of the solutions that we thought were solutions are actually our problems today. We thought a highway system would be a great idea to get things from here to there. Oops.
Well, there's always the law of unintended consequences. And of course, we worry about whether the solutions we're going to effect are going to, you know, turn out to be unfortunate. Nonetheless, I think the world is better off with highways. We just don't want to put highways in the wrong places.
You became an activist, as you said, and realized that you had a responsibility to do that, not only in your science and the kind of science you did, but you lobbied a bit. You went to Washington. You worked on legislation as well.
You know, shame on me. I don't know what the exact definition of the mission statement for Duke University is, but I suspect it's something very close to teaching, research, and community service, because basically that's what every university's mission statement is. There is nothing in that that says that I shouldn't teach members of Congress. There's nothing in that that says that I shouldn't teach in church congregations. There is nothing in that that says I shouldn't engage with the media, which is what I'm doing here right now. So I view that mission to be a broad one, and you bet. I think I'm in not only entitled to, but it's part of my responsibility as a scientist, as a citizen, you know, to, you know, drive the 4.5 hours up, up the interstate and go and tell our elected representatives what the scientific issues are.
Well, how is the feeling, or what is the feeling in general in the academy about that? Are there some people who say, look, stick to your books? And
you know, there is that kind of an attitude. But I think it's changing, and it's changing rapidly. There's always been a worry that by being activist that it will somehow harm one's career. I think all the evidence is against that. I have been very richly honored for the things that I have done. I don't think my career has suffered because I spent time on Capitol Hill.
Tell us about some of the species, the rate at which we're losing species now.
One of the things that ecologists were doing 20 years ago was trying to count the number of species that were going extinct per day. And that was a disaster. And it was a disaster because, frankly, we don't know the names of most species. We know that a lot of them are missing. So what I did was to come up with another measure. And the other measure was how much more rapidly species are going extinct now than in the past. And we know from the fossil record and from some other independent sources that species sort of turn over at the rate of 1 million years. So 1 in 1 million species should go extinct in any given year. So then you can look at the 10,000 species of birds and the 6,000 species of, you know, of frogs and salamanders, and you can say how many are going extinct. For birds, if there's only 10,000, you ought to wait 100 years before you see an extinction. We're seeing bird extinctions every year. And that is where the number of 100 times faster than expected or faster than background, that's where that number comes from looking at groups of species that we know well and looking at the documented extinctions.
Give us an example of a species that has recently gone extinct that you really believe we could have saved.
I think one of the tragedies of what happened in Hawaii, where several species have gone extinct, one, a little bird called the po'uli, which I tried desperately to see and work on before it did expire, is that you've got to get out there and you've got to be energetic and you've got to be aggressive at controlling the factors that cause their extinction. I think it was clear that when this population had gone down to a very, very small number in a very small area of forest, that we had to begin to control, you know, the invasive species of rats and mongooses and things of that kind. I don't think we were anywhere near energetic enough in doing that. I think that's one species we could have saved.
The Endangered Species Act has been in the headlines recently. Last week, there was a moratorium on adding new plants to animals to the endangered species list that was overturned. The moratorium was by the House. How well does the law work in this country?
You know, I think it's a very good piece of legislation. It's not brought a lot of species back, but the ones it has are spectacular. The bald eagle, our nation's national bird, is now something that has become familiar to us. You know, I see them, you know, on the lake just north of town when I'm driving up to D.C. They're now in every 50 states. So we brought a lot of species back. We recovered a lot of species. But much more importantly, we have prevented a lot of species from going extinct. I think it's an effective piece of legislation. I think what we really need to do is to engage landowners more directly, because we don't want them to destroy their land and cause species to go extinct as a consequence, and clearly there are times when they want to do just that. But there are detailed mechanisms within the Act where I think we can find win-win situations, and I think that's the challenge.
You're headed off to Africa soon, and you're working on saving some big cats. Interesting project, and I'd like you to tell us how that project works.
Well, you know, lions and cheetahs are species that are in massive decline. Everybody has this impression of Africa that you get from, you know, looking at National Geographic specials. It's of the national parks, it's of the Serengeti, it's of these wilderness areas. And that's true. And those of us who are fortunate to go there can spend time in those national parks. But you're in what I call the bubble. You stay at a nice lodge, you go out and see the lions, and it's great. But one park that I'm going to be in next week is as good an example as any. It's called Tarangire National Park in Tanzania. The park was set up by the British in the last days of colonial administration. And it's a wetland, so in the dry season, the animals come into this wetland and they drink and they bathe and all the rest of it. But during the rest of the year, they spread out over an area that's four times larger than the national park. And people live in that area. They bring their livestock, their cattle and their goats, into protected areas called bomas at night. And these are made out of, you know, bush and wood. Well, you know, lions are very smart, you know, so you get a lioness and she roars on one side of the boma and the cattle panic and break out of the boma and her sisters are on the other side and grab the cattle. Well, you can't get married in this part of the world unless you have a dowry which you pay in cattle. So people get rather cross if they lost their wealth and their prospects of ever getting a family. So, you know, so they go out and kill the lions. Well, there's a solution to that. And the solution is that you use chain link fence and you build a better boma. And then, and I've heard stories of this, you get lions or hyenas that come charging up to the boma. And of course, they bounce off the chain link fence, which makes them look really stupid. And it works. And since the various grantees through National Geographic's Big Cats Initiative, since these various grantees have built these bomas, we haven't lost any cattle from inside the bomas. These bomas will probably last for 30 or 40 years. The people who own the bomas pay half the cost. National Geographic pays the other half of the cost. And by doing this, we're massively reducing the number of lions that get killed in retaliation. It's a clever solution. It's a locally effective solution. You know, it brings good science to bear on a problem that involves people and wildlife.
And it sounds like, too, that what you're doing is bringing in the social element. I mean, obviously, this is not just a scientific problem. It's not a problem of habitat and sort of quantities of food. People have to live, and they need land, too. We had Rob Dunn on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about his book about parasites and the insight that we are actually an ecosystem, a walking ecosystem ourselves. Seems to me to carry on sort of in the big picture and illustrate the kind of work you're doing. If we see ourselves apart from nature, separate from it, then it's always going to be an arms race. But seeing ourselves as integrated, changing the picture, is a way that we all kind of live and prosper and don't have to annihilate one species after another just to live.
Exactly so. We are part of nature, and what we have to do is to work out ways of living with nature, of treading gently on the landscape. In Africa, we can't put fences around these national parks. For one thing, the national parks would simply not be big enough. So we can't create fortress nature. We've got to find ways in which people can coexist with nature. And that's true of all the other places that that I work. We are very much engaged in working with local people. One of my group, Dr. Luke Dollar, who is a professor at Pfeiffer University just up the road, is, as we speak, on his way back from Madagascar. And what Luke has done there is to help very poor, very remote villagers get a benefit from the national park that's next to them. When Luke asked the women in the village what they could do to earn a living from the national park, they said, we could build a restaurant. People came to the park, saw the lemurs there, went home, never spent any money in the village. So Luke raised the money to build a cement slab, because the dirt floor is not a good base for a restaurant. They built the restaurant. His restaurant, our restaurant, since I helped pay for some of it, has now served, I think, 50,000 meals. We are the best restaurant within 80 miles. We are the only restaurant within the 80 miles. And as a consequence of that, every child in that village is now in school because of the income that we help create. People come, see the lemurs, eat in the restaurant, and now the people in that community understand that that national park next door is worth something to them. And so that when they're lighting their fires to clean their fields, they're very careful now not to let those fires burn into the national park.
Tell us a bit about your work in the U.S. I know you spent time in the Florida Everglades working to protect a number of species, including the Florida panther.
Yes. I spend a lot of time in Florida. It's a politically difficult environment. The Everglades National Park is at the bottom end of a watershed. Most national parks are at the top end, you think of Great Smokies. So there's a lot of stuff that comes from upstream, and some of it's not what we want. It's pollution. It's also a very rapidly growing state. And one of the species is the Florida panther, and it was on its last legs. The population was very small. It was becoming very, very inbred. The males we thought were becoming infertile. And there seemed to be very little hope. The various agencies came together and brought in a few female cats from Texas. The Florida males did their duty, and the population has now increased dramatically. It was, an active intervention. Most people don't see Florida panthers, but it means that we still have some wilderness in the eastern United States, and I think that in itself is worth it.
And was the threat the loss of habitat or the pollution, some combination?
It was really the loss of habitat. Yeah. In the case of the panther. For other species, it's the water supply. I believe very passionately that we have to defend our national parks to make sure they continue to function. They are the crown jewels of our natural environment.
What about people to say, look, we need space, and all of this parkland is space that could be used for human development?
We can have our cake and eat it too. There's plenty of room for people to live, but if we destroyed all of our nature, we would be in a very poorer state. I mean, 1 million people visit Everglades National Park every year. In a good year, 10 million people visit the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. And do we really want to, turn all of Great Smoky Mountains National Park into, I better be careful which city I pick, somewhere on the other side of the border, yeah. Gatlinburg. We don't. We want to have those places. It means something. North Carolinians, go to the Smokies because it's really a beautiful place. And I think that tells us how valuable it is to us.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break right here. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about how technology has changed and how we employ that in ecology, biological ecology, and also take a look at the North Carolina coast, what's going on there. when our conversation with ecologist Stuart Pim continues on the state of things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, spending the hour with Stuart Pim, Doris Duke Chair of Conservation Ecology at Duke. Stuart is also author of The World According to Pim, A Scientist Audits the Earth, and he's the founder of the Pim Group, a land preservation fundraising vehicle housed at Duke. How has the technology changed since those days that you began to worry back in Hawaii in 1970?
The technology now is extraordinary. Less than a decade ago, people would sometimes challenge me and say, how do you know that tropical forests are disappearing? These days, you say, go to Google Earth and take a look. That is the most user-friendly way of seeing what's going on the planet. You can see the planet going up in smoke. You can see where people are building roads. You can see how habitats are being fragmented. The project that we did in Brazil with the Golden Lion Tamarins, where we bought this cattle pasture, you can see that area greening up. You can see it connecting. It's a wonderful process of healing. All of that is stuff that you can see. And you can see the bad guys. The bad guys can run, but they cannot hide. We were involved about a year ago with a major problem of logging in Madagascar for rosewood, which everybody was denying was happening, but we knew on the ground that it was. And we tasked a satellite, and it went over a port on the east coast of Madagascar, and we were able to take satellite images of the logs being loaded on the boats. We have a much better idea of what's going on now, and that enables us to do better planning. We can be more effective, but it also enables us to catch people doing things that they shouldn't be doing, building roads into national parks where they promise not to, for example.
Right, and then again, once you find the so-called bad guys, it's really the bad activities that are going on. It's a question in your mind of replacing that economic activity, not simply shutting it down and saying, "Okay, now you go find something else."
Yeah, what we do in the communities where we work is that we provide alternative pathways for people. Burning tropical forests is, as I said earlier, a very poor economic choice. On what it's going to cost us in what is costing us in terms of increased insurance policies for people who live on the coast, that money ought to be going to help countries reduce their deforestation. That money ought to be going to countries to reforest. But even at a local level, we can make choices. The villagers in Madagascar do not need to burn their forest. We've given them a reason to value that forest. We've changed their behavior.
Here in North Carolina, you just made reference to the Carolina coast, talking about insurance for increasingly endangered real estate. Tell us about the coastal conservation efforts here in North Carolina.
I am not the expert on that. I've got a colleague, I think you know who I'm talking about, who is. And I don't want to blot my copybook, as we used to say growing up, by talking about stuff that I don't know enough about. There are much better people to talk about that than me.
The PIM Group is something you know about. You started it. Tell us about that.
Well, I wanted there to be a sort of a place where my wonderful group of students and collaborators could come together and share what we do. So it's what I do, it's what my students do, it's what my former students do. And it's a place that shows the kind of diversity of projects that we're dealing with. At the moment, we have people in Madagascar, we have people in Ecuador, we have people in Africa, we have people in Brazil. And that's a measure of the kind of very diverse places we work and the kind of diverse projects that we do.
How about the people involved? Are you engaging people who don't have a scientific background?
I think everybody cares, everybody can care about the environment. So we have a lot of very, very different kinds of people who help us. One of the really interesting opportunities in the near future is to use crowdsourcing, as we call it, to identify environmental change. You can give people a little piece of the planet in the form of a satellite image, and you can ask people to be the virtual park ranger for that that piece of the planet. And if somebody builds a road or somebody cuts a forest down, they can let you know. Now, that is about to happen. It hasn't happened yet. But, you know, we're beginning to engage people so that everybody can be part of this.
How about the politics of environmentalism? Has that changed? It used to be very easy to scare big numbers of people into thinking that somehow jobs would be lost and economic activity would come to a standstill. And it was the earth against, it was working people against the snail darter.
You know, the snail darter, because it's so close, it's just on the opposite side of the mountains, is a really interesting case. People opposed the Tellico Dam long before my former colleague David Etnaier found the snail darter. They opposed it because it was the last free-flowing river in the Appalachians. It was a beautiful place. There were Indian burial sites there. It was great trout fishing. And the argument that TVA made was, you know, people versus job, people versus the snail darter, you know, why do we care about this little fish? And their argument, TVA's argument, was that if we built this dam, that a town of 60,000 people was going to grow up around it. Well, shame on TVA, because it didn't, and everybody knew that wasn't going to happen. So the snail darter would have saved we the people, we the taxpaying people, an enormous amount of money. It was pure pork barrel. It was terrible government waste. That stream, that river, was worth more as a river than as a dam that really hasn't done a lot for the people of our area and the people of East Tennessee.
I just wonder if we're any smarter than we were, or how the politics has changed. I mean, you think about the argument over the Kyoto Accords, okay? It takes us back a decade or more. We were convinced again that we were going to lose jobs if somehow we were going to clean the air. Well, the Germans were very happy that we had that argument here, because they're billions and billions and billions of dollars richer and much closer to sustainable energy.
I think the very interesting thing, you know, Germany has just, within the last few days, you know, released a plan that is for very, very substantial cuts in their use of fossil fuels. A lot of it's through efficiency. A lot of it is through alternative technologies. They've obviously had a very different view of how they want to handle nuclear power. I don't think the Germans are doing this because, you know, they want to become poor. I think they're doing it because they want to become richer. And what worries me is that in the long term, this is a battle that's going to be won by smart, entrepreneurial, technically savvy people, and I think we're burying our heads in the sand.
So you think we are? In other words, the politics hasn't changed much here in this country. We're not getting any sharper about the way this political debate goes.
I mean, for Senator Imhoff of Alabama to call global warming, you know, the biggest hoax ever perpetrated on the American public, and now to look at how many days Oklahoma has been above 100 degrees, I think that's very short-term thinking.
Before you were a conservation biologist, you were a zoologist, and before that you were just a kid who enjoyed the magic of nature back in England.
I'm still a kid who enjoys the magic of nature.
Well, tell us about that child in you and the child that child of many years ago. How did that upbringing, and tell us about that upbringing, influence your career?
My parents loved to hike and to walk, and they met on a not exactly a blind date, but they met on an arranged date up in the Pennines of Derbyshire. My mother was from Yorkshire, my dad from Derbyshire, and they met halfway. And so from my earliest days, I hiked in the dales of Derbyshire and up on the moors. And I've always had a passion for nature. I mean, if when people ask me what is the one thing that I can do for the environment, I always say, get out and enjoy it. everything else will follow from that.
Are kids doing that enough these days?
No, but there's no reason why not to. I mean, we are surrounded by wonderful recreation areas. You know, we're not that far from the Smokies. We're not that far from the coast. We Americans are hugely endowed with national parks and state parks and one kind of an area and another. No reason why you can't get out and walk and enjoy the environment.
A lot of your work centers on the tropics and wetlands and areas like that, and yet you spent some time in the desert southwest of this country and loved that as well. What? How does that? I mean, there are a lot of people who think, well, what are you going to say? The desert, a couple of cacti, maybe a lizard and a snake. That's a pretty rich environment, huh?
You know, the reason that I ended up in deserts was that as an undergraduate at the end of my first year, I wanted to be on an expedition, and I got to go overland to Afghanistan and came back and nearly died from, you know, all the bugs that I picked up, but used the time to plan another expedition to Afghanistan. And so deserts fascinated me. So after Oxford, I moved to New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And I'm very proud to be a New Mexico Aggie.
Do you, when you look at the species that still exist, we talked about those going extinct, and yet we are discovering new species now at a pretty big rate too.
We've just published a paper that estimates that about 15% more plant species are likely still to be discovered. Sadly, they're going to be species that are endangered when we do discover them, because we have a prediction of where they're likely to be, and they're likely to be in places where we're destroying the environment. That'll bring the total of plant species on the verge of extinction up to about 30%. About a third of all plants are going to be endangered. So there's still a lot of discoveries to be made. And, you know, particularly with plants, a fairly important fraction of our drugs and medicines are plant-based products. So what we don't know could nonetheless be very important to us.
Seems there, if you look to the future, a few ways we could go. You suggest that we have the means, the ingenuity to reverse the species extinction, to come up with clever, innovative, and productive ways to do that. Another alternative would be just to wipe them all out and use our ingenuity to create an atmosphere and an environment that doesn't need those species. That's sort of the scientific, you know, sci-fi live in a bubble universe. And of course, the third is that we are all extinguished, or at least humankind it becomes extinct because we've done so much damage.
We're not going to go extinct, but the kind of planet that we might leave to our children might be a very much poorer one. You know, being a first-generation American, I watched The Wizard of Oz for the first time when my kids were small, when my girls were small. You know, and there's a line in that where Dorothy says, "Oh, lions and tigers and bears, oh my, will there be wild things out there?" And wouldn't it be awful if, you know, if to our grandchildren or great-grandchildren, we had to reply, no, there aren't wild things out there. I mean, tigers could go extinct. They're declining rapidly. Lions probably won't, but they might disappear from most of Africa. Polar bears may go extinct. And I think the world would be just a poorer place if we do those things. And would we be better off? Well, no. So I think it's a matter of the kind of planet we lead to the next generations. For me, it's a deeply ethical concern.
What do you think is the most urgent need that faces us right now, the most urgent threat?
I've talked a lot about tropical deforestation. Tropical forests are where the wild things are, and our destruction of them makes no economic sense whatsoever. So in a sense, that's the lowest hanging fruit, that we should do something about that, because it's clearly in our vested interest and economically to do that. We're obviously over-harvesting the oceans. We're taking too many fish. I think there are some very encouraging initiatives here in North Carolina, and again, I'm not the person to talk about them, of working with the fishing communities to get – a better product, a sustainable product. But I am worried about what's happening in the oceans. And again, I think that's something that we can fix because it's in our long-term interest to do so.
You don't think we've passed the point of no return?
I do not think we've passed the point of no return. But for some species, we're certainly getting close to that. And then, of course, we've got to do something about climate change because that's going to be a massive economic problem if we don't.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Stuart Pym, for being on the program today. Stuart Pym, Doris Duke, Professor of Conservation Ecology at the Nichols School of Environment at Duke. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
He's also the author of The World According to Pym, A Scientist Audits the Earth, and you can keep track of his research on species extinction at thepymgroup.org. Pym is P-I-M-M. And that is the state of things for today. Thank you for listening to our program. If you have a comment about the show or you want to hear an archived edition of a past program, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. You can find a link to a calendar of events mentioned on the show. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix and Isaac Davey Aronson. Anna Cassell is our intern, Robin Copley, the technical director, managing editor, Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.